Blog Talk Radio.
The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. So mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration when human respect is disintegrating. This whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Think of all the hate there is in Red China, then take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to take rest and tell me.
Hey, everybody. James Bostic here, Conservative Perspective on Patriot Nation Radio Network, doing live radio, old guy style, no video, just the power of this magnificent, mellifluous baritone voice. And it's good to be here with you. Hope you had a great day today. We're doing something. And tonight we're doing it in style because our guest this evening needs no introduction, but he's insisting on one anyway. So he's been likened by many people to Benjamin Franklin in so much as they think he should probably go fly a kite. He is also very witty. He is entertaining. He is compelling.
In a thunderstorm, I might add. In a thunderstorm.
Yes, in a lightning storm. He's an entertaining fellow. He is remarkably intelligent, well-informed, witty, charming, and eloquent, it says here. And I know these things. He is also a gentleman.
I hope he can read what I wrote.
He is also a gentleman, and I know this for a fact because one time I saw him walking out of a room that had that written on the door. Michael Cutler is here with us, and he is a former Immigration Naturalization Services federal agent with almost 30 years of experience, and his bailiwick included drug enforcement, counterintelligence, counterterrorism, immigration fraud, organized crime, all those issues and threats to the country from within and from without through the perspective of immigration. Michael, I'm glad to have you here. It's always a pleasure. And here's what I want to do. I'm going to, before I turn you loose, and you know I'm going to.
Okay.
I have a clip that I want to play, and it is okay. From this weekend. It's just a couple of minutes, and it's from this weekend at the at CPAC. And as you know, Donald okay. Trump was the he was the keynote speaker, and
yep.
I'm just going to go ahead and play it. But it contains something that you and I have talked about, and I know you'll hit upon it as soon as you hear it. And it's the first time outside of my conversations with you that I've heard anybody mention it. Again, here we go. So with that in mind, I just want you to listen to this clip. And then when we're done, I'm gonna cry havoc and let slip the dogs of Cutler.
Is it under my leadership, we will seal it up and expand that wall till we have total control. But we did a great job in the wall, remember, with Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell. Yeah, we'll give it to you next year. I said, nope, give it to me this year. Well, sir, if you approve this budget, we'll give it to you next year. I said, all right, that's okay. So I waited, then they didn't give it, you know? And yet Mitch McConnell approves $5.5 trillion for Green New Deal garbage. It's a disgrace. But I took it from the military because I considered it an invasion. So, Marjorie, I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take it right out of the military because they're invading our country. And I got it built, and we did a great job. We did it quickly. Now we have complete chaos. Fentanyl is pouring in. Families are being wiped out, destroyed. And there's death everywhere, all caused by incompetence. Millions of illegal aliens are stampeding across our border. Interior enforcement has been shut down. Everyone is overstaying their visas. Nobody even thinks about reporting it anymore. My wonderful travel ban is gone. I had a travel ban. It was so wonderful. Refugee numbers are through the roof, and spies and terrorists are infiltrating our country totally unchecked like never before. When I'm back in the White House, the very first reconciliation bill I will sign will be for a massive increase in Border Patrol and a colossal increase in the number of ICE deportation officers.
Okay, now
wow.
You heard it there at the tail
wow.
end of that. Now, again, bear in mind, Mike, and you know, you, for anybody to want, I'm conservative, I'm Republican in my politics. Mike is a Democrat, doesn't mean a damn thing as far as me and him are concerned.
No.
But bear in mind, you know, he's talking at CPAC, so there's a lot of red meat in that for the voter base. But again, I'm going to let you go. You know what I'm talking about. And like I said, the only time
yeah.
that's the only time I've heard anybody say anything about that outside of my conversations with you.
That's right. And I've been yelling about this since before 9/11. In fact, the very first time, you know, I've testified before something like 16 or 17 congressional hearings in the House and Senate. I've been told that it's some kind of a record. You know, normally heads of agencies, federal agencies, routinely appear before Congress. But I didn't appear as the head of any agency. I appeared as an American citizen with specific background because of my 30-year career. And my very first hearing was back on May 20th, 1997, 4.5 years before the terror attacks of September 11, 2001. And the topic of the hearing was immigration fraud and visa fraud because of two terror attacks carried out in the United States back in 1993. We had the shooting at the CIA by a Pakistani by the name of Kansi. He bought into a courier van service. He had applied for political asylum. And in January 93, a cold morning in January, in Virginia, he pulled into the parking compound, the parking lot for the CIA compound in Virginia, because that courier van had a permit that enabled him to park in the parking lot so he could deliver packages. That morning, he delivered death. He jumped out with an AK-47, opened fire, killed CIA agents, wounded others, fled the country because bad guys from other countries have an escape hatch that they can disappear through, that American criminals can't. He went back to Pakistan, but our guys working with Pakistan intelligence caught him, brought him back. We put him on trial. He was found guilty and executed, but it didn't bring back the dead. And the 1 month later, February 93, we had the bombing of the Trade Center. These were all individuals who came to the United States from the Middle East. They were aliens. And what they did was commit a variety of fraud in order to enter the country, conceal their identities, conceal their movements, and carry out an attack that killed six, injured over 1,000, and inflicted a half billion dollars in damage to the World Trade Center. Their stated goal had been to topple the tower sideways to kill a couple of 100,000 people. They probably would have ruptured the seawall. Lower Manhattan would have been flooded. The destruction and the casualty numbers would have been off the charts, worse than any fictitious movie you ever saw. And but for the grace of God, the van was parked on one wall. There were engineers who did the investigation after the fact, said that if they had parked the van against a different wall, they might have succeeded. Or if they had filled the truck to the top with explosives, they might have succeeded, because they didn't. They apparently ran out of money. So the truck was only partially filled. I believe it was three quarters filled. If it had been filled all the way up and or parked on the other wall, most of the engineers, I was told this by my friends who worked on the investigation, the engineers were of the belief that they had a better than 50-50 shot at bringing down the towers sideways.
Wow.
We would have thought that we would have learned our lesson. And in fact, I was walking by Lower Manhattan a couple days after the explosion. It was like a game of pickup lunch instead of pickup basketball. I bumped into an FBI agent I knew, and a cop, and a DEA agent, and an ATF agent, and we all went to one of those wonderful Irish pubs in Lower Manhattan. There's no shortage of them. They're great places. And we went into a back room. The owners recognized that we were law enforcement, so they gave us a platter filled with hamburgers and pitchers filled with Coke, and they said, when you get done, we'll give you the check and you can pay, but we know you guys don't want to be disturbed, so we're going to lock the door, have at it as long as you want. It's a privilege to serve you, which was very kind of them. And, you know, we sat there for a couple of hours. And the consensus was that now immigration would not be ignored anymore because we couldn't. I asked an FBI agent who was joining us for lunch that day, I said, what will you be focusing on if I could wave a magic wand and make all of the criminal aliens in New York disappear? And he looked at me and he said, Mike, I'm going to work on my golf game if you could ever do that. I asked the ATF agent the same question. He said, well, I'm going to go home, take some annual leave, and build the back deck because I'd have no work to do. That's how pervasive criminal aliens are in New York and other cities. And this isn't a statement of xenophobia, it's just a statement of reality. The problem is that there are far too many people making a fortune over open borders. I had a major argument with an individual who testified alongside me at a hearing conducted by the House Judiciary Committee, and this wasn't long after 9/11. And this guy was involved with a company that was affiliated with the United States Chamber of Commerce. I call them the Chamber of Horrors. And the members of Congress had to go vote on some bill or some measure or whatever. And when that happens in Washington, in the hearing room, bells chime and lights flash so they know they have to go vote. So they called a recess in the hearing. And this other witness walked over. He extended his hand. He shook my hand. He said, Mr. Cutler, it's good to meet you. I said, it's good to meet you. And then he said to me, you need to cut this crap about border security. And I was kind of taken aback. I said, excuse me? I said, that's border. And not just the Mexican border, but our borders in general, the ability to keep out people who want to hurt us. That's our first and last line of defense against criminals and terrorists and enemy combatants and spies. He said, yeah, well, to me and my buddies, you know what those borders are? I said, what? An impediment to our wealth. You are costing us a fortune with your big mouth. You need to knock it off. I can't even tell you the thoughts that went through my head at that moment. And I said to him, but if we don't enforce the laws, people will come in and people will die. And he said to me, no one lives forever. Get over it. Can you picture this?
Good Lord.
And I looked at him and I said, you know something? I have a prayer for you. He said, what's your prayer? I said, I pray to God that if there is a terrorist attack, that they do not hurt a hair on your head. He said, that is very kind of you. I said, no, I'm anything but kind. I want you to survive unscathed so that you can witness your family being vaporized inches from your face so you can smell their burning flesh as they die. And he looked at me and said, would you like to step outside? I took off my jacket. He threw himself in his chair. And that was the last nonsense I heard out of that idiot's face. This is what we are up against. Now, let's also consider something else. I was watching Bill Maher this week, and I recommend everybody watch Bill Maher. He has Bernie Sanders on. And I know everyone's groaning and saying, what's wrong with Cutler? Bernie Sanders is a socialist. Well, I don't disagree with Bernie on everything, and I don't agree with him on everything. Just like everything else, you have to pick and choose and understand what we're dealing with. I personally believe that we need Social Security. I know there are many conservatives who don't. I believe we do. I believe that we need to take care of our most vulnerable. But ours, what I mean by ours, are American citizens, not the rest of the world.
Precisely.
Okay? I believe that American children who want to go to college and demonstrate the ability to be successful in college and want to study a curriculum that makes them equipped to do the jobs that our society needs should be able to get a free education. And by the way, my college education was close to free. It was a couple hundred dollars a year. I went to Brooklyn College. It was a liberal arts degree. It's a good thing I got the degree because I could not have become a federal agent without my degree. And the backstory is I had lost my parents to cancer. When I was 19, my dad died. When I was 21, my mother passed away. I was on my own. I had nobody. I mean, I was on my own. It was me and my dog against the world. If I had to pay a significant tab for my education, I would have dropped out. I don't know what would have happened. I believe that American children should be able to get a college education because education is the equalizer. It opens doors. But by the way, we don't only need college degrees. Most of the college degrees are a bunch of, you know, hooey, okay? Women's studies is what you do on the weekend, okay? It's not a course of study in college as far as I'm concerned. How's that? So if you want to be an engineer, my dad was blue collar. He was a tradesman. He had an eighth grade education. He was brilliant. My mother came here at the age of 13 ahead of the Holocaust. We're Jewish. She was she got here from Poland. Her mother couldn't get out of Poland. She wound up living, and she was here legally. Her dad abandoned her. Nice guy. I had no use for that cretin. So she wound up living by herself at the age of 13 in a rooming house, supporting herself at the age of 13 in a new country where she couldn't even speak the language. She worked in a sweatshop making umbrellas for $3 a week, still tried to send some money home to her mother in Poland, and her mother said, don't send the money because the people in the post office are tearing open the envelopes and stealing the money. So there was my mom, 13, working in a sweatshop. By the time she was in her mid-20s, she only had a fourth-grade education. She became the chief buyer for a dress company during the Depression that was so successful that her boss became one of Roosevelt's dollar-a-year men who was invited to the White House routinely to try to figure out how to get America out of the Great Depression. And he frequently pointed to my mother as the reason he was so successful. There is a world of difference between being educated and being intelligent, okay? But my parents said to me, if you're going to go to college, it should be to become a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, a scientist, a biologist, an accountant. I wound up with a liberal arts degree because my ability to study evaporated after my mom passed away. I was, it was a tough deal. And I still miss her. You know, we all go through lots of bad stuff in our lives. We need to be compassionate with each other. My father said to me, he said, Mike, if you could put all of your problems on a clothesline and hang it out for everybody to see, and if all of our neighbors did the same thing, and he said, if you walk up and down the block and look at all the clotheslines, I'm going to bet that you're going to come back for your own problems because everybody has problems and they're really significant. And that's why one of my favorite bumper stickers says, be kind to the people you meet. You don't know the battles they're fighting. Okay? But having said that, my goal was to get a degree and do a job that made a difference. That would be an adventure. That would make a difference. That would be more than a paycheck. And that's what I got as a federal agent. I took the civil service exam. did quite well in it, and the rest, as they say, is history. But what disturbs me is you have kids today putting in all this effort, putting in all this money, and getting degrees in engineering and computer programming and science and all these STEM courses that should guarantee a bright future, and many of them aren't working in those fields because this country has an addiction not only to drugs, but to cheap, exploitable labor. And it's not just the illegal aliens, it's the visaed workers. And when people say to me, well, you know, traditionally the Democrats are looking for cheap votes, that's why they want an open border, the Republicans want cheap labor, I modify it slightly. I think the Republicans have been wanting to cheapen labor so that Americans would be made to compete with foreign workers for the high-tech jobs. Alan Greenspan referred to American high-tech workers as the privileged elite when he testified to Chuck Schumer back on April 30th, 2009. And he said, you know what? We need to make American workers compete with foreign workers, just the way Bill Gates wants. It's great to know that Bill Gates is running our government. He wants an unlimited supply of H-1B visas, and this would be great because if we do it, we could get rid of the wage premium we're paying American workers. And by doing that, we would greatly reduce inequality in wages between Americans with skills and those with lesser skills. In other words, this is about the destruction of the middle class. And what the people on the right, the conservatives, don't understand, when you do this, you push America to the left, way to the left. Because today, most Americans are unable to buy a home. Most Americans are unable to buy a car. There was just a report a couple days ago of the number of people that are 60 days late of making car payments or defaulting altogether. In order to buy a house today, lots of luck. You know, I'm still living in the house my parents bought when I was 11 years old. That was many decades ago, too many decades ago. My father bought this house for $25,500 when I was 11 years old. That represented roughly 3 years of his gross annual pay back in 1959. Today, the average construction worker who wants to buy the same house that I'm sitting in right now as I talk to you would have to spend between 10 and 11 years of his gross annual pay to purchase the house. How in the world do you deal with a mortgage that's that huge? You will not have money to turn the lights on. Forget about having a hamburger for dinner. So more and more Americans are finding it impossible to get by in this screwed up economy. And the inflation created by Joe Biden, and I think it was done intentionally, but what do I know? And as you pointed out, James, I'm a registered Democrat, but I don't follow any party. I think both parties are terrible. George Washington, by the way, shared my abhorrence for the political parties. I'm just going to read a George Washington quote, and then I'll make the point that I was going to make. But this is so important, folks, because think about this. Politicians are beholden to the political party. If they're beholden to the political party, they cannot be beholden to the constituents who voted them into office. You can't be a slave to two masters, okay? George Washington, during his farewell address in Francis Tavern, just miles away from where I live, Francis Tavern, located in Lower Manhattan, this is what President George Washington said about political parties. However, political parties may now and then answer popular ends. They are likely, in the course of time and things, to become potent engines by which cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men will be enabled to subvert the power of the people and to usurp for themselves the reins of government, destroying afterwards the very engines which have lifted them to unjust dominion. Think about that. And so you look at where we are, you look at what the political parties are doing, and they're taking money from various groups, and the reason they're taking the money is because those groups want open borders. They want to destroy wages for Americans. They are driven by unbridled greed. And it's really funny. I mentioned Bill Maher because he had Bernie Sanders on. And Bernie Sanders was asked by Bill Maher about, you know, where we are. He just wrote a book, Sanders. And he said, up until the administration of John F. Kennedy, and I've made this point, by the way, innumerable times, if you ask the average American which party represents the average working class American, the factory worker, the civil servant, the letter carrier, the construction worker. Which party is the party of the average working American? Back then, everybody would have said the Democrat Party. And Bernie Sanders said it's no longer the case. And in fact, it seems as though the Republicans, at least to some extent, are more on the side of the average worker than the Democrats. And the reason that he said that this has happened is because the Democrats are now taking money from the same people that the Republicans have been taking money from. And guess what exacerbated all of this? And this is something that I've been yodeling about. It's the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, which meant that unlimited amounts of money could be pumped into political campaign coffers. I was not allowed to accept a can of soda or a cup of coffee when I was on duty as an agent. If I was thirsty, the most that I could ask for was a glass of ice water. And that's the way it should be, so that there's no even illusion of wrongdoing. I remember I had an old-time boss way back when, Frank Johnson, who would end our meetings by reminding us that as federal agent, it was not enough that we not engage in wrongdoing, but that we must never even give the illusion of doing wrong. And you look at what is going on with Joe Biden and Hunter Biden and the money and China and Ukraine and all this other insanity that the media covered up. See, people ask me if I thought there was tampering in the election, and I'm not sure what to believe. And I don't even know what in the world is going on with Fox now and the lawsuit that's pending. But I made a point when I was speaking to a group of Air Force brass in Washington about a year ago. In fact, my son was with me. These were mostly generals and colonels, and some of them were test pilots and fighter pilots. It's always a joy to get down there and a privilege to address them. And a couple of guys came up to me, and I think they were generals, but they were in their civvies, and I didn't ask for rank. It's irrelevant. But they asked me, do you think that the election was rigged? I said, I don't know what to make of the voting. I certainly don't feel comfortable with it. But I can tell you that the way the media obviously made a concerted effort, I would say conspired, to block any information and any credibility about Hunter Biden's laptop, to me, constituted election tampering. How many Americans said, gee whiz, if we knew about that damn laptop and if we knew about Hunter Biden, we would never have voted for Joe Biden. So right there and then, in Mike Cutler world, you had election tampering. What do you think of that proposition, James?
Yeah, and Mike, they always do the same thing, and you know what I'm going to say. They put the spotlight on one instance here or one instance there, and they always categorize them the same way. It's this isolated incident. Well,
this was a
pattern
of corruption. This was an endemic pattern of corruption by this president.
And it goes, hell, it probably goes back 50 years, but let's just look from the time when he was vice president up to now. And it's unbelievable. It's stupefying.
Well, it's him. How many people go to Washington and poor and come out super wealthy, worth millions or more? Look at Chinese influence among the among the politicians, that it's not just Swalwell. I call him Swallowwell. Dianne Feinstein was
the
chauffeur of 20 years, right?
Yeah.
And the list goes on. And by the way, this thing with Swalwell and the allegations of him cavorting with a hooker involved with Chinese intelligence, I can tell you, if I did that as an agent, not only would I lose my job, I'd probably be in front of a grand jury. We were warned as agents, don't even date somebody who has an immigration issue of any kind. If they're a naturalized citizen, that's fine. If they got a green card, unless they're facing deportation, that's fine. But you get involved with anybody other than that, it's going to cost you your job and maybe do more damage than that to you. Be careful. Okay, you're in the position to be compromised. Be careful. And, you know, and we all were. And here you have the politicians, they believe they're above the law, and no one generally convinces them otherwise. But, you know, going back to Bernie Sanders and what he said about the money and the way it corrupts the system, he's right. And when you drive Americans into poverty, you're forcing them to go to the party of the handout. And guess which party is the party of the handout? Now, what's really amazing, Bernie Sanders in 2006, 2007, right around the time that Citizens United was decided, by the way, appeared on stage with a bunch of union leaders, the AFL-CIO and so forth, and he said unequivocally that anybody who accepts anybody who intentionally hires illegal aliens should be prosecuted because you're destroying jobs and wages for Americans. And suddenly that part of his argument evaporated. So when he was with Bill Maher, everybody here should get health care. Everybody here should get free college. No, absolutely not. Dead wrong. Americans, yes. Dreamers, are you crazy?
No.
Harry Reid stood on the floor of the Senate when he was a new senator and said, we shouldn't give an illegal alien anything, not even the right time of day, essentially, because if you're here illegally, why in the world would you do anything for them? They need to leave. He was right. I testified twice for Sheila Jackson Lee at hearings. I don't know if your listeners remember the incident, but 6 months to the day after the terror attacks of 9/11, this is March 2002, to everyone's horror, it was discovered that two of the dead terrorists, Muhammad Atta, the ringleader, and another cohort, Marwan al-Shehhi, had been granted authorization to, of all things, attend flight school in the United States. They were both dead. The world knew they were terrorists, but immigration screwed up. And these two guys that were approved for flight school were in the cockpits of the two planes that smashed into the World Trade Center in Manhattan. So Sheila Jackson Lee's counsel called me up. I had just come out of a meeting. I was the Parents Association president of my daughter's public school. So they had a meeting with all the local and federal politicians. Anthony Weiner was there. My state senator was there. And I tried to approach Weiner, and we got into a heated argument. I won't even repeat it. That guy was a piece of work. And my son works for him as an intern, and he treated the kids like garbage. He's absolutely
well-named. He's well-named.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I used to call him Anthony Weiner. But, you know, he insisted on introducing me at the hearing when I testified for Jackson Lee, and he did. And if you want, you can actually watch the entire hearing. It's part of the permanent C-SPAN library. It's, I guess, kind of an historic record now because it's forever and always will be part of the 9/11 attacks. And I got a call driving down the block, and I get a call on my cell phone. It was a dumb phone in those days. This is 2002. And there's a voice on the other end of the phone, and the guy said to me, my name is so-and-so. And he said, is this Mr. Cutler? I said, yes. He said, America needs you in Washington. And I thought it was a goof, right? I said, who is this? He said, I'm Sheila Jackson Lee, chief counsel. The Republicans were in power at that point, so she's the minority, not because of her race.
Right.
Minority means that her party wasn't in power, just for your audience if they're not familiar with the terminology. He says, so I'm chief minority counsel for the House Immigration Subcommittee. Are you aware of the fact that two dead terrorists just got authorization to attend flight school? I almost hit the tree in front of my house as he said that to me. I stopped my car in the middle of the street. I was dumbfounded. He said, we're holding a hearing next week. Can you come? I said, absolutely. Let me get to my house. I'll call you back on my landline. I parked my car, ran into the house. The rest is history. You can watch the hearing. Worth watching. And then I testified for Jackson Lee at another hearing about alien smuggling. And I said, we need to go beyond looking at simply the Mexican border. That's only one of many elements. We need to look at visa fraud and immigration fraud because that's how aliens are coming into the country and they're doing us harm. That's how most of the terrorists got here. And I said, you know, if you erect a fence around the building, you generally don't lean the fence on the wall of the building you're trying to protect. You move the fence out to the furthest extremity of the property upon which that building is constructed. And I said, in the world, if you move out the requirements for visas, that moves America's borders out to the embassies and consulates where the visas are issued. And she came to agree with me, and they changed the title of the hearing. And it's interesting because they continued to use the same wording, pushing out the borders. Because visas push out the borders. And by the way, it was Ronald Reagan who gave us the first visa waiver program, gave us the diversity visa, gave us the amnesty. And I make that point because both parties have done this to us, folks. It's not one or the other. And now there's a politician, Vivek Ramaswamy, who said, we need an immigration system. He says he's going to run for president. We need a merit-based immigration system. And this is part of the pablum that we're being spoon-fed. Merit-based, well, that sounds pretty good. So we're not going to do it by familial relationship, which I agree with. This nonsense of chain migration needs to end immediately. It shouldn't have existed. Certainly when an alien gets residency, they should have every right to bring in their minor children and their spouses. We travel as families. Part of the world's problems, or at least America's problems, stems from the destruction of American families, I believe. But that doesn't mean that you can bring in your married brothers and sisters and their spouses and their children and so forth. That's nuts. You know, I have an easy test. Here's who I would give a visa to or green card to when somebody immigrates. Anybody who could be reasonably placed on the health insurance plan for that person. What do you think of that?
Sure. So
if you have health insurance, your wife and your minor children can get health care. In fact, it goes up to age 20 to the 26th birthday or the 27th birthday. Okay, that's fine. But imagine you have a brother who's 48 years old, and he calls up Blue Cross or some other company and says, Mike Cutler is my brother, and I need an appendectomy, so are you going to take care of me? They'd laugh their heads off. They'd say, what, are you crazy? Why would we pay for you to have an appendectomy? Get your own medical insurance. We don't insure you. We just insure Mr. Cutler and his family. You see? And that's how we should look at visas. If you want to visit temporarily, and that's another dirty secret, get a temporary visitor's visa. There's nothing to stop you from doing that. When I was an inspector at Kennedy Airport for the INS during the first 4 years of my career, if you looked at all the major holidays, whether it was Christmas or Easter or Hanukkah or Passover, we had loads of people coming in, and I'd say, what's the purpose for your visit? And they were from all over the world. My brother, my sister, my son, whomever, came to America. They're living here permanently. We're coming to celebrate the holidays. We're coming because there's a wedding. We're coming because, tragically, there was a funeral, whatever. But they come. They're admitted for 6 months maximum. As long as they don't work, as long as they don't get arrested, they're welcome to stay and be with the family, and then you go home. My oldest son moved out of town pursuing his career as an engineer. If I'm going to go visit with him, that's fine, but I'm not going to move in with him. So you come to the United States, you spend Christmas, you spend New Year, whatever, and then you go back to your home country. This nonsense that we're going to bring the whole world here has to end. We're overwhelmed. We can't deal with all the people who are here. We're oversubscribed. But what's so remarkable is that you have someone like Vivek Ramaswamy saying, oh, we need a merit-based system. Well, what does that mean? People that can do the high-tech jobs. Well, wait a minute. Don't we have Americans who can do those jobs? And then you have the politicians who say, well, we need to modernize the immigration laws. And if you ask them what they mean by that, they will say to you, once you get them to fess up, that there's a provision in the law they want to change. The immigration laws now state that you cannot hire a foreign worker when there are Americans ready, willing, and able to do the job in that same geographic location. Not just Americans, but also if someone's here with a green card and so forth, resident aliens. So that way you're not making them compete with foreign workers. That notion goes back to Roosevelt to end the Depression. He said, I'm not going to make Americans compete with foreign workers, because that means that foreign workers will get the jobs. Foreign workers generally will accept lower wages under worse conditions, and just by flooding the labor pool, this is a supply and demand situation, you're going to drive down wages, and we need Americans to make enough money that they can support themselves, pay taxes, do what they have to do, raise their families. It's only reasonable, you see? So on December 2nd last year, just a couple of months ago, here is a CNBC headline. You're going to love this. Tech layoffs send visa holders on frantic search for employment to avoid deportation. Deportation? No one's going to deport them. If the job goes away, you tell them, hey, Charlie, sorry, you had a job. The company is downsizing. You don't have a job. You need to go home. Now, if they can get another company to hire them, that's fine. But shouldn't that other company be looking to hire Americans first to make certain that Americans who are laid off get
Absolutely.
The jobs so they can support themselves? Right? But you don't hear that. There's nothing in the CNBC article that says that the companies that are laying people off, those workers need to go home to provide opportunities for laid off Americans. And believe me, there's lots of laid off Americans. They don't give a rat's tail about laid-off Americans. And so we hear this nonsense. And what's the nonsense that we're hearing? America first. I disagree. Now, don't get excited. I know some people are reaching for their blood pressure pills. It's not that I don't see the issue of America first. For corporate America, that means taking care of General Motors and General Electric and all these American companies that are quick to slap an American flag on the shrink wrap, where most of the stuff that they're selling you was manufactured outside the company, whether it was the materials or the labor or whatever. But it looks real good, you know, that American flag. Wow, how exciting is that? No, I believe in Americans first. We the people first. The decisions made by every politician on every level should be challenged, and they never are, as to how what they are doing is in the best interest of the average American citizen. Please don't tell me what the immigrants want. Oh, the immigrants want their share of the American dream. Wow, I'd like a new Ferrari. Okay? The point is, what is the government of the United States of America doing to ensure the future and well-being of its own citizens? As a parent, my primary concern are my children, right? And now their children, so it's my grandchildren. You take care of your family first. If, God forbid, there's a fire in a school, some tragedy, parents go running into the building, who are they looking to save first? Their own kids. If they could find their neighbor's children, of course they got to help them. You should. We must. But the primary objective for any family should be to safeguard the well-being of their own children. Is that an unreasonable requirement? James?
No, not at all. No, I don't think it's unreasonable. No.
Is America doing that today?
No.
It's not even close. So CNBC is spewing this propaganda. The Republicans are out there saying, well, you know, we can't have comprehensive reform until we secure the Mexican border. Really? What about the other borders? I did a little digging. Now, this is kind of interesting. You know, I've always made the point that there's more than one way to come to America. I wrote an article years ago, and I said that Paul Revere had it really easy describing how the Brits might be coming. All he needed were three lanterns, right? One if by land, two if by sea. Well, if you were going to use lanterns to alert our officials as to how the aliens are entering the United States, you'd need to buy more lanterns than they probably stock in the local Home Depot or Lowe's. And if you lit them all at the same time, you'd probably burn the old North Church to the ground, right? So I went online, and the Customs and Border Protection website, here's some interesting statistics. This is, again, officially from CBP, Customs and Border Protection. On a typical day in fiscal year 2022, that's last year, CBP processed 868,867 passengers and pedestrians, of which 263,000 were incoming international air passengers and crew, 58,549 passengers and crew on arriving ships and boats, and 547,318 incoming land travelers. And what happens once these people get here? Who knows? And Donald Trump made the point. They disappear into the night. Is anybody saying that we need to have integrity to the system by going after people who violate the terms of their admission into the United States? No. All that we're hearing is the Mexican border, the Mexican border, the Mexican border, even though entries across the northern border, illegal entries, are surging now. So why in the world are we hearing this nonsense about, well, once we secure the Mexican border, then we can talk about comprehensive immigration reform? First of all, those two things have nothing to do with each other. Right? Comprehensive reform means giving lawful status to millions of people who snuck into the country, evaded the vetting process we conduct at ports of entry that is designed to keep out criminals, terrorists, spies, human rights violators, fugitives from justice, aliens who would take the jobs of Americans, aliens who have dangerous communicable diseases, or aliens who have become a public charge. That's what's in the law. Go to Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182. I'm going to repeat it so you can write it down. Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182. It basically enumerates all the categories of aliens who are to be kept out. There is not a single word about race or religion or ethnicity. In point of fact, if there was, I couldn't have enforced those laws for 30 seconds, let alone 30 years. Those laws are all about protecting public health, public safety, national security, and the jobs and wages of Americans. Who could be opposed to those laws? Apparently lots of people, because as Trump pointed out, when he asked the Republicans for the money to build the border wall, what did he get? Bupkis from the Republican Party. So when people say, we got to vote for the Republicans, no, we've got to vote for individual candidates who get the point. What do you think of that suggestion? Am I wrong?
It's like, no, I think you said the first person, and it's important, I think, to make that decision as opposed to America first and Americans first, because you remember the old saw.
Isn't that a reasonable change?
Yeah, no, it's certainly reasonable, because you remember that old saw, if it's good for General Motors, it's good for America.
Right.
But that doesn't necessarily mean it's good for Americans.
They moved their factory. So when we bailed out GM and they moved their factories to China, how was that good for America?
Well, it certainly wasn't good for Americans either.
No, it wasn't. No, it
so
wasn't.
So what you're talking about and the point you make is totally valid. And that's, I think that's, that needs to be the mindset if we're going to make any serious course corrections in terms of what's going on in general, let alone with simply.
I agree with you. And that's what every one of you who are out there in the audience listening needs to do. You need to reach out. I don't care if it's the mayor, the dog catcher, or the president of the United States and say, wait a minute, how are these policies helpful to the average American citizen, to the average American family? You know, I remember, and you're a school teacher, you could appreciate this, when I was first enrolling my oldest son in kindergarten, it's a big event. You go to the school and the parents were there. And they had something called the Eagle Program. And it was an enriched program for kindergarten. And I mean, I don't want to make light of what we do in kindergarten, because it starts, you know, at the bottom and you work your way up. And we're really blessed. Every one of my four children are honor students. They graduated with honors. I have two engineers. My daughter works for a publishing house. She has a degree in English, graduated with honors. My second oldest son has a master's degree and works with learning disabled children, as does his wife, and they graduated with honors. These are really bright, successful, motivated kids. But, you know, it starts with kindergarten, and we build on each, just like building a house, the first layer of bricks and so forth. But my goodness, you had parents having a meltdown because their kid was not put into the Eagle program. You would have thought they were denied entry into medical school. We had parents screaming, yelling, jumping up and down, having a complete meltdown because their kid didn't make the Eagle Pro. They were going to be in kindergarten, but it wasn't Eagle. Oh, my God, right? Well, if you're that concerned about your children's education, think what happens when you flood millions of children into our country who are incapable of reading, writing, or speaking English. The Congressional Budget Office did a study back around 2007, I believe, and they found that it costs 20 to 40% more to educate children who are not English proficient. So not only are we flooding children into the schools, which is, of course, stressing the available system, how many kids can you have in a classroom, how many teachers do you have, how many classrooms do we have, how much money is being allocated, but now we have to add to that English as a second language. So the money that should be going to early intervention for children that have learning disabilities instead is going for English as a second language. And who's getting the short end of that stick? The American students. And this is particularly pronounced in neighborhoods of poverty. So there are no opportunities for the parent to say, I'm going to hire a tutor, or we're going to look for a different school or whatever. So we're doing the greatest harm to the people least able to do what's needed for their children. But of course the politicians don't care. And now, through critical race theory, they're telling Americans of color that the problem they have stems from, you know, the whites are the problem. And you know what scares me on this issue, and it's really important to think about this. My family, and was certainly not the only one, decimated in the Holocaust. And the nonsense that was peddled to the Germans was that the reason they weren't doing well was because the Jews had taken their success. And they were whipped into a frenzy. In fact, it's really interesting. I was originally a science major. Had I not lost my parents, I probably would have been an engineer, as two of my kids are engineers now. But I've always been a science guy, and I was watching an interesting documentary about Albert Einstein. And in fact, I wrote about this, the science Nazis, in an article for Front Page magazine a couple of years ago. And I didn't even realize that I knew that Einstein had to get out of Germany because it wasn't a good thing to be a Jew in Germany when the Holocaust started to rev up. This was in the early 30s. But the Nazis actually had an organized campaign, a systematic campaign against Einstein, accusing him of practicing Jewish science, and they specifically went after his theories of relativity. And they organized tens of thousands of Germans on campuses to riot anytime Einstein showed up, and they did it to several other Jewish scientists. Einstein fled Germany fearful that they were going to kill him. It worked out for us, didn't work out for Germany, thank God. But the point of the matter is, when you start to scapegoat one group of your citizens against another group of your citizens, the results are not good. We need to understand that as Americans, we should be pulling for each other. We should be wanting everyone to be as successful as we can. You know, life, as I've mentioned so many times, is a tough proposition. It should be a team sport. And we should be working with each other. We should be taking down barriers. And we should create what America used to be, and that's a meritocracy. Ed Koch was one of New York's best mayors, although he allowed the sanctuary policies, but way back when, it wasn't the problem that it is today. I think he meant well, and you know the old saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. But they asked Ed Koch, the quintessential New Yorker, if he could describe why he was a liberal. And he said, well, I'm an old-fashioned liberal. And they said, well, what's an old-fashioned liberal? He said, well, an old-fashioned liberal says that you do whatever you have to do to level the playing field. And once you level the playing field, you let everybody play, and then whoever wins, wins. And I buy into that. If we have kids living in poverty, not based on their race, religion, ethnicity, none of that, but if you're living in poverty and you need help, you need a computer, you need tutoring, whatever it is, we should be providing it to help maximize the achievements of every American child. Not telling them, you know, your desire to get ahead is futile because you're never going to succeed because some other group of Americans has taken your success from you. No one can take anybody's success from anybody. My parents raised me because, to be blunt, anti-Semitism is a problem. And it's disgusting. And I'll tell you a funny story. I met John Lewis, if you remember the congressman who was a civil rights icon. And Sheila Jackson Lee introduced me to him. I was asked by Lamar Smith or John Hostetler to attend a couple of congressional hearings in Washington, not as a witness, but just to give them feedback about my thoughts about the credibility of some of the witnesses. And these were two hearings back to back about border security, immigration, law enforcement, and problems with drugs, Mexico, and so forth. So I certainly agreed. You know, I was working very closely with them in those days. And when they took a break between the two hearings, Sheila Jackson Lee came up to me and said to me, Mr. Cutler, I'd like you to meet an icon in the civil rights of America, the civil rights history of America, John Lewis. And I wound up chatting with him. He was very affable, very down to earth. And we got into a conversation about civil rights and about righting the wrongs. And I said, you know, throughout history, it's not only blacks who have suffered. People have always suffered because of the stupidity, animosity, and bigotry at the hands of every other group of people. We get to be tribal, and it gets very dangerous. We should be looking to find what makes us most similar, not what makes us different. But I said, I just want you to think about something, Congressman Lewis. He said, what's that? I said, what you did to fight back against the atrocities committed in against the blacks was an amazing thing. In fact, I knew James Meredith, the first black man to go to Mississippi University. We had met, and he actually rented his Volkswagen. That's how I learned to drive stick shift. We were talking about it because he and James Meredith were good friends. And so we're having this very nice conversation. But I said, you know, I'm Jewish, and my people were enslaved long before your people were enslaved. Pick up the Bible. I said, so I'm against anybody who practices racism, bigotry, anti-Semitism, It's not acceptable, period. We should be treating each and every other human being with dignity and respect and not hold people accountable for the things they can't control. I can't control my Jewish heritage. I wouldn't want to. You can't control your skin color. These are factors out of our control. You can be made accountable for what you do and don't do, but not for who you are, whether we're talking DNA or whatever else, right? But I said, you should know that bigots like the KKK probably hate and fear me more than they hate and fear you. He said, why? I said, you're obviously black, but I'm not obviously Jewish. So to the bigot, Jewish people are like undercover black people. And I want you...
That's pretty good.
Well, do you know that both he and Sheila Jackson Lee doubled over in the middle of this House hearing room and they could not stop laughing? How's that for a one-liner?
Undercover black guy. That's pretty good.
And that's one of the things that I've learned along the way. Sometimes humor is the most effective tool or the most effective weapon that we have in our arsenal. And, you know, he shook my hand and he said, Mr. Cutler, I never would have thought of that, but you've made me see things from a different perspective. And that's the beauty of having disagreements or conversations. Nothing should be off the table. I am a liberal, but not the kind of liberal that we're calling liberals today. These people aren't liberals. You think they're liberal? The cancel culture is not liberal. Liberal means that you celebrate the First Amendment. My parents taught me from the time I could remember, they said, Mike, not everyone's going to agree with you, and people are going to see things differently. But just because they disagree doesn't make them your enemy, and even if they do disagree with you, they have as much right to be heard as you do. That's what liberalism is supposed to be. What do you think of that?
Well, yeah, in its classical sense, in the Jeffersonian type, these guys have co-opted that term. The people, the extreme
right. So
left that use that today
them?
Have co-opted
so why do we
that
allow
term.
Them? Why do we allow them? Because you
I
have
do
people
not know.
That don't think very deeply, and they say, oh, I'm a liberal. He says he's a liberal. I guess he's a kindred spirit. No, that guy is the antithesis of liberalism. These people are authoritarians. They are thugs. They are fascists.
Oh,
they are bullies. Well, people, and then they say, well, they're progressive. No, they're not. They want to go back to segregation. They're not progressive. They are regressive. Never let your opponents define you. Make sure you define who they are. These are authoritarian regressives. What do you think of that?
Spot on. Yeah, like I said, they've hijacked that.
Yeah.
Like I said, again, that they've hijacked the language. They've hijacked the term.
And we allow
it. Has nothing
to
do with liberal.
And that gives them strength. And that gives them strength, and we need to deny them that opportunity. What do you think of that?
Yeah. Call them what they are.
And make that point when you speak to your neighbors. Because if you really are liberal, would you believe in cancel culture? Of course not. Of course not. So now, moving right along, you look at what happened to Miss Lightfoot, or I call her Lighthead in Chicago. She got her comeuppance, to use a term that one of my old bosses used to use. And that should be a cautionary tale for every one of these politicians. Look, I agree with certain changes needed in the criminal justice system, okay? We can always tweak it. You know, the Founding Fathers understood in order to make a more perfect union, right? So the idea that some guy that can't come up with $200 bail because he has a speeding ticket and he winds up spending 3 weeks in jail is nuts. That's wrong. But it started out that way, and immediately we were talking about criminals. It's not enough to get the guns off the street. It's about getting the people wielding the guns off the street who want to do harm. I took a lot of guns off the street as an agent. These were criminals. In one case, the guy was an IRA terrorist. We put him on trial, in fact. I've taken a lot of very evil people off the street. I used to joke that I sometimes felt like a human garbage collector. Murderers, rapists, child molesters, gangbangers, drug traffickers, the best of the best. What can I tell you, okay? But if you want to make the people safe, then criminals need to be arrested. And I took a class in criminology, believe it or not, back at Brooklyn College. And my professor made an interesting point. He said the reason that we put people in jail and we prosecute people is so that people don't take the law in their own hands. If some guy's sister gets raped, everyone has to believe that the system will deliver justice so that he doesn't have to go out there with a baseball bat, right? Maybe you raped my sister, but you're going to go to jail for 5 years. So cool. Everyone says the system is working. That's not happening anymore.
No.
And I fear vigilante justice. I certainly don't want to see it happen. That's the last thing America needs. We need to cool down the rhetoric, and we need to take the temperature down on the level of violence. But look at what is happening now in Georgia, where a law enforcement training center is being built, and you have crazies, and it's not just from Georgia. There was just a report about how there were people arrested. I think it was 30-odd people arrested. According to Fox News, one was from Canada, one was from France. Making this, by the way, an immigration story. How did they get into the country? They shouldn't be here, and they certainly should be deported once they serve whatever prison sentence they might get for the crimes. But if you want to have law enforcement that's more effective, here's what you need to do. Pay more money for the people that you hire so that you get better qualified people. Spend the money on training. And maybe when you have people that burn out, because law enforcement is a very stressful profession, believe me, I speak from experience. And not everybody can deal with the day-to-day stress, so they lose friends on the job, and I've lost some very close friends. It affects you. And if you're so affected that you can no longer function in a law enforcement environment, then we ought to offer people an early out. You go into the military, you do a 5-year hitch, we thank you for serving America, and you move on with your life. You become a librarian, a school teacher, you open a restaurant. Right? You can do whatever you want to do with your life. You made your contribution to America's safety for 5 years, 8 years, whatever the hitch was. And then you move on. Why don't we think of doing that in law enforcement so that if somebody is having issues because of post-traumatic stress, because of whatever issues, you shake their hand, you thank them for their service to the community, you give them a reduced pension. Certainly you're not going to give a guy that served as a cop for 6 years the same pension that you give someone who served for 30 years. So they get a partial pension, and maybe even that city can find non-law enforcement employment for that cop who should no longer be out on the street. Maybe he wants to be a school teacher, right? Maybe he would rather drive a truck for the city. There's whatever it is that he wants to do, and give them first shot. You were in law enforcement. We now owe you because you put it out there for us. And we'll help you find another career within the city where you can continue to build your pension. There's creative things that we can do to help the men and women of law enforcement if they decide that they've had more than they can bear. What do you think of that idea?
By God, that is a remarkably novel concept. And I'm just listening to you lay it out there like that. And why didn't you think of this sooner, Mike?
I actually did. I mentioned it a couple of weeks ago to some people.
No, I'm not kidding. I think that's a terrific idea, what you're talking about. And just like in the military, there would be lifers, but, you know, you would be able to, you know, but there, you know, there's a vetting process, and you'd be able to have safeguards in place to look after those guys if they couldn't make it 30 years. But, no, I agree with what you're saying.
Doesn't that make sense?
That's a really good idea.
And you know, I do an internet blog talk show also on Friday nights, the Michael Cutler Hour. So here's a little story about the Michael Cutler Hour. A number of years ago, I'm going to guess it was over 10 years ago, I was approached by a gentleman. His name was Tom Garcia. Tom Garcia was trying to put together some kind of a little radio network on blog talk. I think he still does a show, Tom. I spoke to him a couple of months back. But Tom Garcia is an American Airlines pilot. But he wasn't always an American Airlines pilot. If you want to talk about being privileged to call somebody a personal friend, Tom Garcia was a naval aviator and became a Top Gun instructor. How's that for a wow?
Nice. Very
and
nice.
So, is that cool or is that cool?
Totally. Top Gun, man, that's the best of the best right there.
Yes, and he was an instructor. And, you know, Paul Valley's another close friend of mine. He retired as a two-star general in the United States Army. I've met some incredible human beings, incredible Americans. I'm blessed, I mean, really and truly. But Tom Garcia decided he'd had enough of aviation for the Navy, and he became an airline pilot, okay? Nothing wrong with that. There's no shame there. That's my point. We need to provide people with a way out of a career like law enforcement, like the military, that doesn't devalue what contributions they've made to make us safer and better off, you see? There's
well,
things
you know,
we
Mike,
can do.
If you think about it, too, when those guys get done, okay, their law enforcement hitch, 4, 6, 8 years, whatever you're talking about, when that's done and they move off into the regular world, into a civilian type job, they're still going to be providing, what's the word I'm looking for here? There's still going to be a very strong adhesive in our society because of that law enforcement experience, no matter where they go, no matter what they do.
And they'll take those skills with them their entire life. Right. And if they leave on good terms, they still can get a carry permit.
Right.
So they're in the position. I have a carry permit. I spent 30 years in law enforcement. I have a carry permit. So if you're in a situation with the training and discipline that became the hallmark of your career, you're still in the position where you could save a life given certain sets of circumstances. I mean, to me, there are creative ways that everybody wins. You follow what I'm saying? But we're not looking for creative, and we should be. So let's go beyond that. All we hear about now every time there's a shooting is we need gun control, right? Instead of saying it's good that they have a base for the cops to get better training, they want to take down the base. And then the representative of the NAACP said, we've militarized the police, and they shouldn't have those big, scary, long guns because it scares law-abiding people. So let's understand what we're talking about.
Doesn't bother me at all.
They used to, in New York, they had something called the Hercules teams, and I thought it was idiotic. They would surge cops to a street corner at random in New York, and they would jump out of the cars in full body armor with submachine guns and Kevlar helmets. What is this, trick or treat? I thought it was idiotic, and they don't do it anymore, by the way. That's stupid. But you do need an element of law enforcement that can respond to an extreme situation and respond quickly, to be mobilized quickly. There was an incident in California perhaps 20 years ago, I don't know if you remember it, where a couple of armed thugs, heavily armored as well as heavily armed, hit jewelry stores and so forth, engaged the cops in shootouts, and even though they were taking hits to the body armor, they weren't going down. And the cops had to run to gun stores to get long guns to equal what they were up against. Okay? And so that's when these ideas of SWAT came into being, special weapons and tactics. There was a terrible shootout in Florida involving the FBI where they were outgunned. They were up against people with semi-automatic handguns, and all they had were revolvers. Right after that, all federal agents were told, get rid of the revolvers, we're going to semi-automatic, so that if you are confronting a situation like that, your firepower is equal to that of the bad guys. You know, there were signs up in many of the agencies where I work, because I had desks at the FBI, DEA, ATF, and what they said is, and the military has the same philosophy. If you find yourself in a fight and you're equally matched, somebody screwed up the planning. Okay?
Right, yeah.
You go in with superiority of numbers and firepower to discourage a shootout. When we would go through a door and you had five agents with long guns and a body bunker, one of those big shields, and you tell the guy on the ground or else, he looks at you, he knows that if he doesn't comply, you're in the position to vaporize him. I never engaged in a shootout that way. They just looked at the superiority of numbers and the superiority of firepower, and that was it. Game over, right? So it's like the Strategic Air Command. They flew their bombers with nuclear weapons right up to the borders of our enemies. And why did they do it? Show a force to make it clear that we weren't going to be pushed around. You never negotiate for a position of weakness. Someone needs to teach that lesson to Joe Biden and company. And the motto of the Strategic Air Force was, peace is our mission. They weren't armed to the teeth to engage in war. They were armed to the teeth to discourage people from taking them on. You see my point?
Yes, absolutely.
So when people say, oh, my God, they got the longest. No, you shouldn't be out on patrol with a submachine gun. That's nuts. But you need units that can respond within minutes if something develops, whether it's a terrorist attack or a mass shooting situation. You need people who can get to the scene quickly, who have whatever equipment is needed and are super proficient in its use to neutralize the threat to save innocent lives. That's the goal, right? Life-saving, not life-taking. That's the reason for guns. My gun was always a defensive weapon. Every day before I went on duty, and I'm not a particularly religious man, to be honest with you, but I nevertheless said a little prayer every morning when I went on duty. Dear God, please don't make me need to use my firearm today. I came close on two or three occasions to having to shoot people. Thank God I did not have to. We resolved things at the last second. And it was a horrible feeling. I remember sweat running down my back like a waterfall. Because the last thing a normal human being wants to do is shoot another human being. I can promise you that. But the idea is the weapon is there to save lives, not to take lives. You follow my point?
Absolutely, I do, yes.
And that's what this is about. So if we're going to talk about gun control, I remember, and I told you this off air earlier, when my dad handed me the keys to my family car, he said to me, Mike, never forget that a car can be as lethal as a gun. Be careful, right? So when we see these terrible accidents, and tragically they happen all the time, some guy blows a red light, plows into a school bus, kills five children, injures four more kids, kills the school teacher. We've seen these wrecks. I'm not going to go into it. You know what we're talking about.
Right.
And the first thing in the report is, well, the guy was had the double blood alcohol, triple the blood alcohol level, had prior arrests for drunk driving or reckless driving, or he was street racing. By the way, street racing. How in the world do they have on cable television the outlawed street racers or whatever they call it, glorifying people racing their cars on public street, which is number one, illegal, and number two, kills people? We have lost our minds as a society. I mean, you wonder why there's violence. You look at the movies, you look at video games. You know, if I was in charge, and I know someone's going to yell censorship, and so be it. Sometimes, you know, you don't cry fire at a crowded theater. No 12-year-old should be playing a video game that glorifies shooting people or running people down with cars or stealing vehicles and going after the cops. Baloney. You want to do street race? You want to do car racing on a track? That's great. You want to do a flight simulator? That is really cool. You want to play Mario? Go for it, right? There's all kinds of things you can do with video games that aren't glorifying violence. Half those video games today could be simulators for combat soldiers. Am I wrong?
No.
And the movies are all about violence. Some guy gets mad and he drives his car through a guy's house and blows up the house and kills everybody with a machine gun. And you have 12-year-old kids that are latchkey children. They come home to an empty house. They turn on the videos, they turn on the television, they watch a movie, and there's no one there to sit down with them and say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't appropriate, or you need to realize this isn't real life. So suddenly you have kids that are being desensitized.
Exactly.
Right? And now let's go a step further. So you have an incident, some drunk driver kills a bunch of people, a bunch of children, everyone goes crazy. And no one says we need car control. Have you ever heard someone say we need car control?
No.
We need to get the drunks off the road, right? We need to have an interlock so that if you're drunk, you can't start the car. You've seen that. Is that car control or is that driver control? Now, here's my argument. If someone goes out there and mows people down with a gun the way a drunk driver mows people down with a car, why is no one telling us what the toxicology report was? I'd love to know how many people engage in mass shootings or even single shootings, especially mass shootings, multiple shootings, is operating that fire under the influence of some kind of a substance. Because when you look at the 100,000 killed by the drugs that flow freely into the country thanks to the Democrat Party. Did I say Democrat Party? Gee whiz, that was a slip of the tongue. The Democrat Party. Democrat Party. Gee, I don't know. Well, anyway, so the Democrat Party is complicit and complacent about all these drugs pouring into America, and the Republicans aren't far behind as far as I'm concerned, because I'd like to know why the Republicans aren't running ads, public service announcements every half hour, warning people about fentanyl and how it could be disguised as a regular pharmaceutical or candy. Right? You want to talk about building a party of the people? Say to people, look, maybe the other party doesn't give a rat's tail, but we do. And you better know that when your kids are getting what they think are pharmaceuticals from a friend, that they may die because children are dying this way. Nobody should be taking drugs unless they walk into a drugstore and buy it from a pharmacy, right? Why aren't they running ads like that? Look at what happened to cigarette smoking when they started to run the ads about cigarette smoke. I can't bear to watch those commercials. My dad, may rest in peace, died of lung cancer, in part because he smoked Chesterfield blowtorches, as I call them, and in part because in the construction trades he was exposed to asbestos, and he was particularly exposed to asbestos when he worked in the Navy shipyards during the Second World War trying to help our war effort. His brother was already in the Army Air Corps, and for those of you familiar with the history of it, after the five Sullivan brothers died on board the same ship in the same incident, if you were the sole surviving male member of your family, you were not allowed to go into the military. They didn't want to see more families suffer the way that the Sullivan family had suffered. My dad's brother was in the Army Air Corps. They wouldn't take him. He actually tried to enlist a couple times under a fake name, but they figured out who he was. He was desperate to kill Nazi bastards, which I could certainly understand, okay? So yeah. He said, if I can't kill these pieces of work, then at least as a plumber, I can work on the ships that are getting the job done for our boys. And he told me about the battleships that he worked on with the blood-spattered decks. Okay? My dad, in his own way, was a hero, right? He gave his life, in part, defending America by working in those shipyards, as did how many other hundreds of thousands of hard-working men and women, you know, Rosie the Riveter. This was an all-hands-on-deck effort, literally, right? We were all in this together, right? So my point is, you look at those cigarette commercials, I can't bear to watch them because I watched my father die that way, and it was terrible. Well, if you can be that effective in getting people to stop smoking, why can't we be that effective in getting people to stop using drugs instead of encouraging drug use by legalizing marijuana and decriminalizing the possession of hard drugs? What am I getting wrong here? You tell me, James.
I can't see anything that you're getting wrong, Mike. It is a question of will. That I mean, really, it's a question of political will and a genuine desire. Again, we can go back all the way to the beginning to where it is Americans first, and our yep. leadership needs to be looking at what's best for the citizenry.
But here's the problem. How much money is going through the money wire services being laundered through real estate, Wall Street, and the banking industry?
Trillions.
Right? Yes.
Trillions.
And in fact, if you look at it this way, we're being told, oh, my God, the cartels are now moving into the United States, and we just had this horrible kidnapping in Mexico in Matamoros. And I went to Matamoros. When I went to Border Patrol Academy, it was the academy was in Los Fresnos, Texas, which was next door to Brownsville. Brownsville is right next to the Mexican border. So we used to go into Brownsville, and then we would just walk across the bridge. In fact, my uncle that I had mentioned earlier during the war had moved to Texas. So when he passed away, I went to his house to help clear up some of the stuff that needed to be tended to. I brought my two boys. We drove down, and we actually walked into Matamoros. And there wasn't a big drug dealer. I would never have taken my kids there if there was. The way that Mexico became drug capital or drug haven for the cartels is because of the way we went after the Colombian cartels, because they used to send most of their drugs into the United States on speedboats into South Florida. Remember the TV series Miami Vice?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that's how the drugs were flowing into America until Ronald Reagan told George Bush, who, unlike Kamala Harris, took his responsibility seriously. He said to him, you're going to figure out a way to stop these damn boats and all these drugs. So So he dispatched the Coast Guard and the Navy to interdict the boats. And then our prosecutors worked with Colombian prosecutors to go after the cartels. So we were reaching into Colombia to prosecute these bums. Well, after a short while, the cartel leaders said, you know what? We're going to have to give up some of our profits. We'll let Mexico get half of our profits, but half of something is better than 100% of nothing. And they started to move the drugs into the United States through Mexico because we were successful at interdicting many of their boats coming up through Florida. And that's why when I testified before Congress years ago, and I keep saying this, immigration, border security is like a balloon. If you squeeze one end, it's going to bulge somewhere else. If you only focus on the Mexican border, you're not going to stop illegal immigration and you're not going to stop the drugs because they're just going to send it a different way. I don't know if you still do this. I do it once in a while, but before I had a GPS in my car, when I got in my car to go somewhere, the first thing I would do is turn on one of the news stations because every 10 minutes they would broadcast the weather and the traffic report.
Right.
So if I was going to go into Manhattan and let's say there was an accident in the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, I would say, okay, today's the day I take the Brooklyn Bridge. Oops, there's an accident on the Brooklyn Bridge. I'm going to take the Manhattan Bridge. That doesn't work out. There's always the Williamsburg or the Midtown Tunnel, right? So you were figuring out where the blockages were, and you would get around the blockages by taking an alternate route. Do you think the smugglers operate any differently? They do the same exact thing. They have spotters along the border to see where the Border Patrol is. And so when you have politicians saying, we don't need 87,000 IRS agents, we need 87,000 Border Patrol agents, that's bunk. You can't hire enough Border Patrol agents to really secure the border if there is no interior enforcement. Because believe it or not, folks, if I ask you how many miles of border does America have, some people will say 2,000 thinking about Mexico. Some people aware that Canada has a 4,000-mile border will say 6,000 miles. The real story is we have over 100,000 miles of border because of the coastline of the United States. Okay? So the real key to immigration and the real key to border security is interior enforcement. Interior enforcement. And that's why I'm so gratified that Donald Trump made that point. Interior enforcement is the key. And it's not just about arresting the people that overstay. It's about going after immigration fraud. I want to read something because I think this is really important for everyone to understand just how important interior enforcement is. Okay. And you know, I gave testimony to the 9/11 Commission. And the 9/11 Commission staff also wrote their own report, the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. This was an official government report that was prepared by the federal agents and the lawyers who were assigned to work with the 9/11 Commission, and this report was published by the government printing office. So this was as much an official report as the actual 9/11 Commission report, okay? And the preface to that report begins by saying the following. It is perhaps obvious to state that terrorists cannot plan and carry out attacks in the United States if they are unable to enter the country. Yet prior to September 11, while there were efforts to enhance border security, no agency of the U.S. government thought of border security as a tool in the counterterrorism arsenal. Indeed, even after 19 hijackers demonstrated the relative ease of obtaining a U.S. visa and gaining admission into the United States, border security still is not considered a cornerstone of national security policy. We believe, for reasons we discuss in the following pages, that it must be made one. Well, I just want to dissect that real quickly. Who in the world did they hire to run federal agencies that they didn't have the brain to figure out that border security is national security? Seriously. But on the other hand, notice they didn't mention Mexican border. What did they talk about? The relative ease of obtaining what? A U.S. visa. Think about that. Do we even talk about the visa process? Do we even talk about this agency known as Citizenship and Immigration Services that adjudicates applications for green cards, for political asylum, even for U.S. citizenship? No. And in fact, under this administration, Mayorkas has stated that when people lie to get U.S. citizenship, he will take no action because now that you're an American, you're entitled to 100% of the protection of the U.S. government. Well, just a second here. if you lied to get U.S. citizenship, then you really shouldn't have U.S. citizenship because it was ill-gotten. You don't call the money you steal in a bank robbery earned money, okay? You don't just say to the IRS, yeah, I stole $100,000 from the Acme Bank, so here's my share of the taxes on my earned money. No, it's not earned money. It was stolen. So if someone lies to get citizenship, they're supposed to be denaturalized. That is called citizenship fraud. And if it involves terrorism, the penalty can be up to 25 years in jail. This is serious. And you got Mayorkas saying, we're going to take absolutely no action. You're an American, and we will protect you. Really? Do you know that when our guys raided the bin Laden compound and they took out his library, there were two items in the library that I found of particular interest. They found a copy of the 9/11 Commission report, and they found an application for United States citizenship. And if you look at many of the people that have been arrested for terrorism here in the United States, you found that they became naturalized citizens because their handlers overseas told them, before you do anything, get that U.S. passport, because with two passports, you can cover your tracks as you travel around the world. Okay? So that's item number one. But let me even underscore it further. Bear with me. This is, again, from that report. Once terrorists had entered the United States, their next challenge was to find a way to remain here. Their primary method was immigration fraud. For example, Yusuf and Ajaj concocted bogus political asylum stories when they arrived in the United States. Okay, so let's analyze that. Most of the people being led into the country now by the Biden administration are being allowed to file applications for political asylum. Now, what does that mean? The political asylum system right now has millions of applications in the inbox. They can't deal with that workload, period. So once someone files an application for asylum, they are good for years and years and years, and no one's going to look for them. And even if you bump into them, the guy is going to say, oh, I have a hearing date 5 years from now, 3 years from now. I don't even have a date, but here's my paperwork telling me that they'll reach me when they're ready for me. You know what? You can't arrest that guy as an illegal alien because he's already been served with papers that shows that he's known to the immigration authorities. You think about this, because it gets even worse as we move along with something else I want to read to you. But let me just make another point here. So they mentioned, for example, Yusuf and Ajaz concocted bogus political asylum stories and they arrived in the United States. Mahmoud Abu Alima, involved in both the World Trade Center and Landmark plots, received temporary residence under the Seasonal Agriculture Worker Program after falsely claiming he picked beans in Florida. That was fraud. Mohammed Salome, who rented the truck used in the bombing, overstayed his tourist visa. In other words, he was an illegal alien, yet he was able to rent the truck, right? Mohammed Salome, who rented the truck used in the bombing, overstayed his tourist visa. He then applied for permanent residency under the Agriculture Worker Program, but was rejected. Iyad Mahmoud Ismail, who drove the van containing the bomb, took English language classes at Wichita State University in Kansas on a student visa, but after he dropped out, he remained in the United States out of status. He was able to drive the truck, and he was an illegal alien, and now we're giving illegal aliens driver's licenses. Even as they put up barriers to protect against car bombs and truck bombs, we have no idea who's driving the vehicles. But it gets worse. As they say in those infomercials, but wait, there's more. Okay? Page 54 of that report, terrorist travel tactics by plot, include this excerpt that makes this issue crystal clear. Although there is evidence that some land and sea border entries of terrorists without inspection occurred, these co-conspirators mainly subverted the legal entry system by entering at airports. In so doing, they relied on a wide variety of fraudulent documents, on aliases, and on government corruption. Government corruption. Interesting. Because terrorist operations were not suicide missions in the early to mid-1990s. Once in the United States, U.S. terrorists and their supporters tried to get legal immigration status that would permit them to remain here, primarily by committing serial or repeated immigration fraud, by claiming political asylum, and by marrying Americans. Many of these tactics would remain largely unchanged and undetected throughout the 1990s and up to the 9/11 attack. Now, catch this paragraph. Thus, abuse of the immigration system and a lack of interior immigration enforcement were unwittingly working together to support terrorist activity. It will remain largely unknown since no agency of the U.S. government analyzed terror travel patterns until after 9/11. This lack of attention meant that critical opportunities to disrupt terrorist travel and therefore deadly terrorist operations were missed. Then page 61 says, exploring the link between human smugglers and terrorists. In July 2001, the CIA warned of a possible link between human smugglers and terrorist groups, including Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Egyptian Islamic Jihad. Indeed, there's evidence to suggest that since 1999, human smugglers have facilitated the travel of terrorists associated with more than a dozen extremist groups. With their global reach and connections to fraudulent document vendors and corrupt government officials, human smugglers clearly have the, quote, credentials necessary to aid terrorist travel. And finally, we get to page 98, and this pulls it all together in a nice little package, and they even put a little bow on this. Catch this, James. This is under immigration benefits. Terrorists in the 1990s, as well as the September 11th hijackers, needed to find a way to stay in or embed themselves in the United States if their operational plans were to come to fruition. As already discussed, this could be accomplished legally by marrying an American citizen, achieving temporary worker status. By the way, folks, temporary worker status, that's DACA, okay? It all comes together. Temporary worker status or applying for asylum after entering. There we go again. And we now have millions of applicants for asylum, right? In many cases, the act of filing for an immigration benefit sufficed to permit the alien to remain in the country until the petition was adjudicated. I'm going to interrupt this and tell you again. Because of the numbers of people allowed in by Biden, the amount of time they will have here is many years. Many years. It should be a couple of weeks or a couple of months. Many years. Thank you, Joe Biden. Thank you, Mayorkas. Thank you, Kamala Harris. Many years, okay? Terrorists were free to conduct, that's right here. Terrorists were free to conduct surveillance, coordinate operations, obtain and receive funding, go to school and learn English, make contacts in the United States, acquire necessary materials, and execute an attack. Let that sink in. What do you think of that?
We've talked in the past about these folks who talk about the immigration system being broken, and you've pointed out with many, many examples, no, it's not broken. It's working exactly the way that they want it to work. It's the way they've designed it to work.
And now they're calling the people coming across the border migrants. They're not migrants. Migrant has nothing to do with immigration. We have thousands of migrant farm workers who are U.S. citizens and never cross the border. They go from state to state or farm to farm, and that's why they call them migrants.
Right.
Okay? If you look up the dictionary, a migrant is someone who travels around looking for work. It doesn't mean you leave the country or come into the country. So they don't want to use the word alien, which is only a legal term that means any person, not a citizen or national of the United States. By the way, the word alien does not seem to be problematic for the open borders crowd when they talk about the DREAM Act. Most people forgot this, but the DREAM Act is actually an acronym. It's an acronym for Development, Relief, and Education of Alien Minors. So because now it suits the narrative, alien minors is perfectly wonderful. Just don't you say alien or they'll come for you. They will cancel you, okay?
Right.
So I've come up with a new idea. When Jimmy Carter, who started this crap about don't use the word alien, or else, I said we're going to call them what they are, pre-citizens. And that caught on. In fact, I had Border Patrol agents calling me up, and everybody was calling them pre-citizens. Well, I've got a new name for them now. You ready, folks? The people coming across the border in record numbers are now clients. They are the clientele of immigration law firms, and they are the clientele of these so-called NGOs, non-government organizations, laughably referred to as nonprofits. nonprofits, they're getting hundreds of millions of dollars in money. And think about this. The omnibus spending bill, that monstrosity, that grotesque monstrosity, contained $4 billion to address the border crisis, but not a penny to be used to secure the border, but for the care of the aliens coming across, or the migrants, as they call them. Really? So what does that mean? It means $4 billion for lawyers and $4 billion for the NGOs. So the money goes to the lawyers, the money goes to the NGOs, and then these groups will make campaign contributions, so the money goes round and round. You know, like the music goes round and round, the money goes round and round, and where it stops, no one knows, except someone ought to check Joe Biden's bank account somewhere along the way. This is what we're dealing with. These are clients, and everyone's getting filthy rich, and Americans are dying in record numbers, and we went to war over the terror attacks of 9/11 because 3,000 people were killed, and rightfully so. And I want to point out that it took 19 hijackers to kill more people on 9/11 than we lost to the entire Japanese fleet at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. But as horrific as that number was, we've lost even more people since then because they were sickened by the contaminants that were spewed into the atmosphere when the towers collapsed, right? And they're still dying to the tune of one every 10 days or so here in New York, believe it or not. And that's why they've allocated billions of dollars in health care. But we lose over 100,000, and it's not fentanyl overdoses. An overdose is a guy that shoots up and puts too much stuff in a needle, or it's more potent than he thought it was. That's an overdose. These people are poisoned because the fentanyl is being disguised as something that it isn't. If I gave you an aspirin and it had cyanide in it, they would take me away in handcuffs for poisoning you, for killing you.
Yeah.
So this isn't overdosing. This is poison by China, by the cartels. You have Iran operating throughout Latin America, by the way, with the drug cartels moving people and narcotics into the United States. I want to read something to that effect. I want everyone to see what the dots are. Because you know what was so remarkable for me was after 9/11, there was a fascination with dots on Capitol Hill. I want a dollar for every time some politician cretin, to give the redundancy, stood before the cameras, pounded the podium and said, "Why didn't they connect to us?" Okay, I was going to send them a box of crayons, okay? So why didn't they connect the dots? So we're connecting the dots once again. So I want to read to you something. There was a hearing on April the 17th, 2018, by the House Counterterrorism and Intelligence Subcommittee, and the topic was the state sponsors of terrorism, an examination of Iran's global terrorism network. Okay, I watched the hearing. Interesting hearing. It includes an excerpt from one of the expert witnesses, and nobody disagreed with him. You know, as I mentioned earlier, sometimes you could testify at a hearing and there are other witnesses that say, no, Cutler's got it wrong. And you go back and forth and it's a hearing. Okay. Nobody disagreed. Everyone said, yep, he's right. Now, this is what he was right about. The excerpt is from a gentleman by the name of Dr. Emmanuel Ortolenghi. He is with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. It's just two paragraphs. The first paragraph is upsetting. The second paragraph is what keeps me awake every single night, folks, just so you know. And this is what Dr. Ortolenghi had to say. In recent years, Hezbollah's Latin American network, think about that. You think Hezbollah, you think Middle East, right? Wrong. They're in the Middle East, but they're here. In recent years, Hezbollah's Latin American networks have also increasingly cooperated with violent drug cartels and criminal syndicates, often with the assistance of local corrupt political elites. We keep talking about that corruption, folks. Cooperation includes the laundering of drug money, arranging multi-ton shipments of cocaine to the United States and Europe, and directly distributing and selling illicit substances to distant markets. Proceeds from these activities finance Hezbollah's arms procurements, its terror activities overseas, its hold on Lebanon's political system, and its efforts both in Lebanon and overseas to keep Shia's communities loyal to its cause and complicit in its endeavors. Well, that's a pretty bleak picture. Now fasten your seatbelts and please make certain that your tray is in the upright and locked position because here we go. It's quick and painful. Ready? toxic crime terror nexus, that is Hezbollah and the traffickers, both of people and drugs, often one and the same. This toxic crime terror nexus is fueling both the rising threat of global jihadism and the collapse of law and order across Latin America, that is helping to drive drugs and people northward into the United States. It is sustaining Hezbollah's growing financial needs. It is helping Iran and Hezbollah consolidate a local constituency in multiple countries across Latin America, thus facilitating their efforts to build safe havens for terrorists.
He's gone. Well, I'll be damned. Well, Mike has dropped for just a second. I'm confident he'll call back. Hopefully he'll realize here in just a minute what's going on. We've been talking as we do periodically here, because he's a frequent contributor to ACP, with Michael Cutler, our friend. He lives in Brooklyn, New York, and he's a former INS, Immigration Naturalization Service federal agent with close to 30 years experience in the immigration game as it pertained to drug enforcement, organized crime, human trafficking, counterterrorism, the whole schmear. If it involved immigration, Mike was probably right at the nexus of what was going on. Hopefully he'll call back. And you've been listening to A Conservative's Perspective here on the Patriot Nation Radio Network. We do well, I was going to say we do this live a couple times a week, but that's not true. That's not true at all. It was true for a long, long time, but it's not that true these days. But we're working on getting that reestablished. We've added a video component to the program through StreamYard, and I'm still trying to up the production value and make sure that we look good and sound good at the same time. And so until I get that worked on and perfected, you know, we'll be doing it here and there. Plus, right now I'm busted on Facebook because a couple of weeks back during the Chinese balloon thing, I posted a picture of the Chinese balloon, okay? And underneath it, somebody had stuck a picture of Hunter Biden in his underwear with that scarf around his neck, you know, the iconic classic Hunter Biden look. And they popped me. I can't go live on Facebook for, I don't know, 12, 13 more days. Anyway, I'm halfway through my stretch. And so once that's over with, look at seeing some pretty interesting shows. Thursday, I could talk about Thursday's show while I got you here too. Free range journalist Sean Bradley Withman will be with us once again. He was ground zero for January 6th. He's got some pretty disturbing things that he wants to talk to us about concerning East Palestine, Ohio. It's bad, people. It's bad. And I hope you guys will tune in for that, because Sean's a terrific guy, and he is a remarkably reliable journalist. If he's reporting something, you can hang your hat on it, and that's rare these days. I'm not exactly sure what happened to Michael, and you know what? I hope not, but it's possible that he's still talking. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to send him a text. Let's see. Mike, you dropped. Is everything okay? Maybe he'll try and call back in. That's what I'm hoping for. If you get this, call back in. We got a couple of minutes. If you get this, comma, call back in. We have a couple of minutes. All right, let's see. So, what's new with you cats? Anything? Oh, it's always a treat, Tam. I tell you what, I met Mike Cutler at say no more. And he's back, ladies and gentlemen. Mike Cutler, undercover black guy. I think he's back. Why can I not hear him? What in the world? I've got speakers on. I don't have Mike. Mike, I can't hear you. I'm not exactly sure what's going on. It's like everything went dead. It's probably that damn CIA. They probably jumped on the NSA. They jumped on us because we were talking about sensitive information. Who knows with these guys? I can't. Let me try something. Mike, if you're there, just hang tight. If you can hear me, hang tight. If you guys out there can hear me, hang tight. I'm not exactly sure what happened. But we're working on it. I think this didn't happen at the beginning of the show. We'll see what's going on here. Wow. It looks like we've gotten cut off. I'm not exactly sure what's happened. Blog Talk is like this sometimes. Again, ladies and gentlemen, I apologize. We had Michael Cutler on with us, as we are wont to do, and then all of a sudden the line went dead. He's back on, and I can see him on the switchboard, but can't hear anything that he is saying. Hello.
Hello.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay, Will.
You can hear me.
You can hear me.
We'll hit the mute button on that.
Okay, can you hear me okay? Hello, James, can you hear me?
Yes. Ah, thank heavens. Good, Mike.
There we go.
Good.
Okay.
All right, I'm not exactly sure what happened, and in my panic to get you reconnected, I have no idea where you cut out at.
Okay. Well, anyway, the bottom line that I'm making is that we have allowed people into our country from Iran who wanted to carry out a political assassination.
Right.
In fact, one guy actually had an employment authorization document. So he was known to immigration authorities, and he's been indicted, apparently, and charged with planning to kill this woman. So someone needs to take a hard look at how this guy entered the country, how he was given an employment authorization document, what the vetting process was. We've had cases of translators working for the military who, it turned out, were actually working for ISIS. And when you're a translator, you have access to the people, to the documents. You're the eyes, ears, and mouth of both people in the interrogation. This is one of the most sensitive jobs someone can have, and we've repeatedly seen this problem. And now, by the way, the FBI a couple of months ago requested something like $15 million in emergency funding to look for and track down Afghan refugees that we admitted that weren't vetted, thanks to Joe Biden and the way that we left Afghanistan. These are all immigration stories that are not being portrayed as immigration stories, because these are people who came into the country, and now that they're here, they're out there, and God only knows what plans they're making and what their ultimate goals are. How terrifying is that?
It is a sieve. I mean, as far as getting into this country, it presents no challenge to those who are well-trained and committed to doing that sort of thing. And, yeah, it's horrifying. And when you compound that with the number of driver's licenses that are just being handed out without
yep.
any kind of vetting at all.
It's
yeah,
insanity.
Every truck on the road, every van, every tractor trailer.
Yep. And we have no idea who these people are. These are self-inflicted wounds, and I want to understand how our government is looking out for us. Their number one mission should be our security. And God forbid, if there's another attack, what are they going to say? We didn't connect the dots? Sorry, that ship sailed. It's not just Mike Cutler. There have been many, many people who have gone before Congress who participated with the 9/11 Commission to identify these vulnerabilities. So that BS story that we didn't know and someone should have connected the dots have been well connected and the spaces have all been colored in, okay? And yet that what they're doing now has left us more vulnerable today, I would argue, than this country has been since its founding, okay? Since its founding. If you thought we were at risk the day before 9/11, we were secure that day. And you look at the carnage from the drugs and the damage to the children, and you have nobody standing up and saying, what in the world are we doing? Why in the world would we displace American workers with foreign workers? Why in the world would we flood America with foreign students? And you have Republicans saying we need comprehensive reform. Well, think about this. We keep getting this nonsense. Oh, there's 11 million aliens. No, there's not 11 million. By now, there's probably 40 to 50 million. And if you legalize them, that means there will be no interviews, there will be no field investigation, but they will all have an immediate and absolute right to bring in every single one of their minor children and their spouses. So let's say we only have 30 million illegal aliens who apply for lawful status. And let's say on average they only claim 4 children. Do the math. 30 million times 4? Seriously? America would implode. And, you know, I know there's floods right now in California and snow, but there's other parts of the country that have record levels of drought. Every person who's here needs 100 gallons of water a day for sanitary purposes, for cooking, for drinking, et cetera, et cetera. Biden supposedly let in 5 million. I think it's a bigger number than that. But 5 million, that means 500 million gallons of water per day are being consumed by people who shouldn't be here. These are people that also need electricity, and the power grid can't handle the load now, and they want to have only electric vehicles. The impact is across the board on infrastructure, hospitals, education, transportation. This would overwhelm America. I used to say the Comprehensive Immigration Reform should be named the Terrorist Assistance and Facilitation Act because you'd be giving millions of people lawful status without an interview, let alone a field investigation. Now I've given it a second new name. I call it the Overwhelm America Act. And you have Republicans that are saying, yeah, let's do this. They say the system is broken, but they're going to allow America's locksmith, which is what Citizenship and Immigration Services essentially is, to deal with a workload that they've never had to deal with, even as they're processing probably upwards of 10 million applications per year. Let's add to that how many tens of millions of more applications? And it only took 19 terrorists who gamed the immigration system to carry out the attacks of 9/11. I'd love somebody to explain to me what any politician is thinking if he or she thinks this is a good idea. How's that for laying it out, James?
That it's spot on. And again, Mike, it comes back to this. There are trillions at stake.
Yes, but you know what? We may know the price of everything, the value of nothing, but if you destroy this country, what future do you think these knuckleheads are going to have? What do you think will become of their families, their children, and their grandchildren? I mean, there's greed. I get it. I don't understand it, but I know there are people that are like that. But my gosh, these people are trying to saw the branch off of a tree, but they're sitting on the wrong side of the damn branch.
Yeah, they're on the wrong side of it, exactly.
Right?
We've got about 5 minutes left. Mike,
yep.
We've got about 5 minutes left. And
okay.
Once again, I am never going to miss an opportunity to have you on the show. I'm never going to miss an opportunity to talk to you, period. But in the next 5 minutes, tell everybody where you're going to be, what you're doing. Talk about the
sure.
Michael Cutler Hour, and
okay. Sure.
whatever
yeah.
words you want to use to give us the benediction.
Okay. If you go to Front Page Magazine, I've been writing for them for years. I haven't written anything in the past month or so. I'll be honest. I'm just so overwhelmed. I don't even know where to begin because what this administration has done is to hammer us from 20 different directions at the same time, which is, again, I think the plan. And I think the idea is to create a uniparty in the United States, and the Republicans, out of greed or stupidity, don't seem to get that they're about to become extinct if they don't end this. Because if you drive Americans to the left, they will only vote for the people that offer the handout. That's the Democrat Party, and the Republicans will go the way of the dodo bird. Please understand what we're talking about. So I write for Front Page Magazine. I appear on occasion on Newsmax TV. My own radio program is the Michael Cutler Hour on Blog Talk Radio, 7 p.m. Friday night, East Coast time. But if you go to the Michael Cutler Hour, you can click on the links and you can listen to all of my podcasts there. And my own personal website is Michael Cutler, C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. But here's the thing, folks. If this program has you fired up, if it has you concerned, it should be. If you're a good parent, good aunt, uncle, grandparent, whatever, this is about the future of our children and their children. Please have conversations with your neighbors, and let's get away from allowing the evil enemy of our country to divide us, which is what their goal clearly is. There is so much more that unites us than divides us. James pointed something out, and it's true. I'm a registered Democrat. I can't tell you the last time I voted for Democrat. But there aren't too many winners on the Republican side either. Both parties are all in. And when they talk about a bipartisan agreement on immigration, I don't call it bipartisan. I call it something else. I call it a collusion, okay? And my father taught me that people will treat you the way you permit them to treat you. We need to let these politicians know that we're not the lunatics or the fools that they've been playing us for. They need to understand that we are on to this game that they are playing, and it's a game that threatens the very survival of our nation and the very lives and survival of our citizens. And if you sit down with your neighbors, and I don't care what their color is, this nonsense about identity politics has to stop. But it's remarkable how Fox News screams about identity politics, and then the very next story they do is about how likely blacks or Latinos are to vote for a particular candidate. That's nuts. As Americans, we all want pretty much the same thing. We want to live in safety. We want a bright future. We want especially a bright future for our kids. And we want to know that anybody who's willing to work hard, study hard, and benefit from a little bit of old-fashioned good luck can write the next great American success story. And, you know, what's so frustrating to me, I was on a program with a conservative who said to me, in America, there's no guarantee of outcome, but there is a guarantee of opportunity. I said, there's no longer a guarantee of opportunity when you import an army of foreign workers that's greater than the number of new jobs that we create. But I said, there most certainly is a guarantee of outcome. And he challenged me, and he said, I defy you to prove that. I said, I could prove it with two words, golden parachute. How many companies have been driven into the ground, and their employees who work their tails off get escorted out the door by an armed security guard to make sure they don't take a pen or stapler with the company logo, while the former CEO walks out the door with tens of millions of dollars? Is that not a guarantee of outcome? We have allowed this to happen. We need to turn this around and get these politicians to understand that we won't play their game anymore. They better start playing our game, we the people. What do you think of that?
I think it's been a lightning fast 2 hours once again. Our friend Michael Cutler joining us and doing what he's done since the first time he was on this show 3 years ago, talking about whatever the hell he wants to. And I wouldn't have an opportunity
and your generosity with a microphone.
Oh, you have a home here, Michael, and I know you know that by now. We've got a minute left. I'm going to go ahead and say goodbye to our friend. Thank you once again, Mike. I appreciate your generosity. I appreciate your sharing it with the audience. And more than any of that, I appreciate your friendship. Thank you so much.
Same here, buddy. Thank you. Be well. Stay safe. Get involved, folks. Democracy is not a spectator sport. See you soon.
Take care. Oh, what a terrific guy. I swear, that's just great. And we're down to 41 seconds. We're going to be back Thursday again, or maybe Wednesday. I'm not really sure. I'm working on that. With either audio or video, I'm not real sure about that either. But again, like I said, I'm working on it. And we're going to have Sean Bradley Wissman with us. And it's going to be a riveting program, and I'm going to encourage you to tune in. As soon as I figure out when it's going to be, I'll let you know. God bless you. God bless America. That's all the time we've got. We'll be back sometime here shortly, taking a look at things as we do through a conservative perspective. You guys take good care of yourselves.